This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. We have an eclectic show for you today. We're going to zoom from how the new administration in America is affecting Israel in the Middle East, up to the rise in left-wing violence in Germany, and then new evidence showing just how special and unique life on this planet really is. First, the administration of Joe Biden in America is quickly shaping up to be the most anti-Israel administration in American history. And this after the most pro-Israel presidency in American history in Donald Trump. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal over in Jerusalem, looking at a handful of the Biden cabinet picks that show just how dangerous this could be for the Jewish state. Then to Germany, where there's been a notable surge in Antifa and other left-wing violence over the past couple of years. Last year was a record year in the number of violent crimes committed by the left. We talk quite a bit about the violence or the extremism on the right, but this is another trend showing the mood in Germany and a certain sickness in European society that we need to watch out for. This will be explained to us in a report from Trumpet writer Josue Michels. And then this recent evidence about life on Earth. The more that scientists study it, the more they realize just how unlikely it is that life exists on this planet at all. There are so many factors that have to fall into place just so, and that's just to prevent life from being wiped out once it's here. That doesn't even address just how miraculous it is that life is here to begin with. Trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic will bring us a report on this recent scientific evidence. And then we'll finish today's program with a last word encouraging you to seize the opportunities life gives you. We'll start, though, by looking at what the Biden administration has revealed in its first few days about its approach to the state of Israel in this report from Brent Noctegal.
Americans have long recognized a fundamental brotherhood that exists between the state of Israel and the United States. The view that Israel has the right to exist in its historic homeland and should be supported by American power as it faces calls for its destruction is shared by most American voters. And yet for the last 12 years, instead of being a unifying force among America's political class, support for Israel has caused immense contention. For the last 4 years, President Trump led the most pro-Israel administration in American history. Before him, President Barack Obama led the most destructive. Now, with Mr. Biden taking office, there's every indication that the pendulum swing will happen once more. According to Israeli commentator Carolyn Glick, the Biden administration is shaping up to be the most hostile U.S. administration ever. Glick made these comments last week after the Biden administration announced that Meher Bitar was to be appointed to serve as the senior director of intelligence at the National Security Council. When there are no fruits to show so early in an administration, it's political appointments that reveal where the government policy is heading. For Israel, several of Biden's picks show that a potentially cold, dark 4 years are just beginning. Bitar is a Palestinian American whose history of activism against the state of Israel is well known. As Glick related, Bitar was a former leader of the anti-Semitic Muslim Brotherhood-aligned Students for Justice in Palestine. In that role, he organized campaigns to delegitimize Israel and once chaired a conference where participants discussed how to indoctrinate Christians to believe that Israel has no right to exist. Crucially, Bitar made his splash into politics when he formed a role inside the Obama administration as the Israeli-Palestinian officer on the National Security Council. He was also deputy to Samantha Power, Obama's UN ambassador who presided over America's parting shot at the State of Israel, where it refused to veto a powerful anti-Israel resolution a month before Obama left office. And now Bitar will be holding one of the most powerful positions in the American intelligence community, despite his complete lack of history in the intelligence field. He will ostensibly decide which intelligence is shared with the president. And as Biden's gatekeeper, he will also determine priorities for intelligence operations and collections. As a former National Security Council member told Glick, Batar will control the information everyone sees. And by controlling the information, he'll control the conversation. Normally, this role is reserved for intelligence officials with a history of dealing with highly sensitive information. Now it's going to a political activist whose main claim to fame is delegitimizing the state of Israel. But Batar is not the only worrying choice by Biden for Israel. Several others from President Obama's Israel-hostile staff have joined Biden's team, particularly those that were involved in negotiating the Iran nuclear deal. John Kerry, Jake Sullivan, Wendy Sherman, William Burns are just a small sampling of Obama's nuclear deal team that have made it over to the Biden administration. These picks that empowered Iran once are no doubt calling for Iran to be empowered once again. While the details of the contents of the nuclear deal are often lost on Americans, there isn't one American ally in the region that thought the nuclear deal was a good idea when it was implemented in 2016. 5 years later, that consensus still hasn't changed. In fact, there is even relative agreement among many in Washington's think tank class that are against rushing into a new deal with Iran. Former official Dennis Ross recently admitted that the Trump administration's, quote, maximum pressure campaign has certainly created leverage that should not be discounted, end quote. He advised that Biden should consider seriously the elements of his predecessor's approach worth keeping. Nevertheless, Biden's picks show that he wants a deal with Iran right away. Nothing highlights just how desperate he is to empower the fanatical regime in Tehran, like the appointment of Robert Malley as his special envoy to Iran. Naturally, Malley is another Obama veteran. In 2008, he was called in as candidate Barack Obama's foreign policy advisor. However, when it was made public that Malley had met with leaders of the Hamas terrorist group, he was dropped from the team as to not be a hindrance to Obama's election hopes. True to form, Malley returned to Obama's team after the 2012 election when his terrorist ties wouldn't hurt at the ballot box. In 2014, he became Obama's senior director of the National Security Council, the position now held by Batar. In 2015, he became Obama's lead negotiator for the Iran nuclear deal. And now that he's back, it is a sure sign that Iran can expect another favorable deal. As Jonathan Tobin wrote last month, Malley is, quote, Iran's ideal candidate for the position of American envoy. Republican Senator Tom Cotton also deplored the choice of Malley, tweeting, quote, Malley has a long track record of sympathy for the Iranian regime and animus toward Israel. The Ayatollahs wouldn't believe their luck if he is selected, end quote. But lucky for Iran, Malley was selected. But not lucky for Israel. His appointment proves that Israel can expect another American deal with Iran, but not a better deal. Iran has said that it expects the United States to undo President Trump's financial sanctions and reimburse Iran billions of dollars in lost revenue. And that's just the starting point. With Obama's man leading Biden's Iran negotiations, it's easy to see that Iran will get exactly what it wants. That the Biden administration would be so quick to head back into a deal with Iran is unsurprising, considering how critical the deal was to President Obama. As Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry shows in his article, The Barack Obama Mystery, the Iran nuclear deal was not a mistake by the Obama administration, where it was fooled by Tehran's negotiators into accepting a bad deal. Instead, the deal was a deliberate attempt to empower Israel's chief enemy. It was motivated out of President Obama's deep hatred for the Jewish state. In fact, as Mr. Flurry proves, Obama's successful efforts to remove President Trump's National Security Advisor General Michael Flynn revolved around his horrifying desire to continue empowering Israel's enemy through preserving the nuclear deal when he was out of office. But Michael Flynn aside, President Trump was still able to put a pause on those wicked purposes by exiting the nuclear deal and inflicting suffocating sanctions on the Iranian regime. President Trump also rectified Obama's horrific treatment of Israel by a series of decisions that promoted Israel's strength and security. In a sense, President Trump's administration saved the state of Israel from Barack Obama's destructive designs. Following President Trump, many Israelis hoped that a Biden administration would stabilize the alliance. No one expects him to show the same favor toward Israel as President Trump did. In fact, many Israelis would be happy with a little less attention on the world scene right now. Israel would be satisfied with a normal American president, like George Bush or Bill Clinton. But that's just not going to happen. From his personnel choices, Biden is showing that his policy towards the Jewish state will be the same as Barack Obama's. This should be a worrying proposition for the state of Israel, but not one that is without hope. As Mr. Flory wrote in his recent feature article, Why I Still Believe Donald Trump is Coming Back, Mr. Biden's tenure in office will be short-lived and will be replaced once again by President Trump. As Mr. Flory notes in that article, God has used the unusual presidency of Donald Trump to temporarily save the United States. And by extension, God has preserved the brotherhood with the state of Israel. While many are aware, the bond between America and Israel is founded in the biblical history, with both nations being modern descendants of the ancient Israelites. Because of that shared biblical history, Israel now finds itself in the crosshairs of America's own culture wars. One side wants to fundamentally change America and with it crush its connection to the state of Israel. And at the other side, wants to preserve America's heritage and safeguard that brotherhood. Based on biblical prophecy, we know that America and Israel will be saved from the destructive forces of the Biden administration. But this saving is only temporary as well. It is a brief window of time that God is giving so that our nations can wake up to that shared biblical history and return to the shared God of Israel.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. It is very concerning to see what a dramatic shift is taking place in Washington. And from Israel's perspective, this really has to be of a major concern. And it's remarkable, I guess, just how quickly the Biden administration is moving on these moves. Israel's going to have to move quickly as well.
Yeah, and that's what has been quite surprising to many in the United States and even in Israel, just how fast the Biden administration is working this and not being afraid of acknowledging, especially its negotiating team, packing the administration with people that want the Iran deal desperately. I mean, I'm not a great deal maker, but I know that you don't want to show your hands too much. And so if you put all the people in there that you did the deal with the first time and that have spent time, if you talk about I talk about Mali for the past 4 years working at a think tank pushing the next Iran deal, I mean, it becomes pretty obvious that you're very interested in it. I think what we are also seeing is that we see a Biden administration that doesn't feel like that it needs to be restrained by its by the voter anymore. Mm-hmm. With some of its policies, typically you see the outlandish policies taking place in the second term. President Obama didn't put through the nuclear deal till his second term. Why not? Because he knew it would be extremely unpopular with Americans. Mm-hmm. And it was, and it still is, and yet the Obama administration does not fear that. And I think that this is something that we are going to see broad spectrum across the board, is unrestrained political actions where there is no fear of blowback at the ballot box anymore because of moves that they will take to try and, as they pack the court or change the amount of states that can vote to ensure that, or even accept so many
mail-in ballots,
illegal citizens,
they've got a lot of tools in their toolbox here. And I think that's an excellent point. I mean, you really are already seeing that broadly, that they don't seem to have any sense of restraint based on the fact that 75 million Americans voted for Donald Trump or anything else. They're just going all in.
Yeah, and I think that there is so many more than that. The nuclear deal is unpopular among Democrats. That's just one example, but I can just see that over the next few weeks, the typical slow-moving first term, after you get out of the shadow of the previous administration, there's always some changes that are made quickly. However, again, this is going to be fast. It's going to be very obvious. And in terms of its relationship with Israel, personnel is policy, as it said, and the personnel fits Obama's third term and a group of people that aren't friends with Israel.
You know, we spoke, I think it was last week, about how Israel is already talking about how it's going to have to go it alone in its dealings with Iran, and they're preparing to attack. And it just reminds me of the prophecy of Israel going to Germany for help. If you're seeing this kind of about face from the White House, you just wonder if while Joe Biden is in office, if that might not hasten Israel's efforts to find an alternative ally to America.
Yeah, and I think you are right with this. We know prophetically that Israel is going to turn to Germany for help and in its protection. And we could certainly see that being a key element of the nuclear deal that America is going to try and push. Back the first time, it was the French that really pushed back hard, or tried to, against the Obama administration, against some of these parts of the deal that were horrible. And is that going to be Germany this time? Is that going to be European nations that try and stand up to a U.S. that is seen as hostile against Israel because of its empowerment of Iran? And if that happens, you could definitely see Israel warming to Germany as a critical ally in the future. Bible prophecy tells us that it is going to be a German-led Europe that finally gets the gusto to attack and eventually destroy Iran and its proxies. And you could see that Europe will become more of the stronger defender of Israel during the Biden administration, for sure. I mean, right now, in times of Israel, they have another Israeli minister just came out and said that the U.S. will never attack Iran's nuclear facilities. We have to do it alone. Mm-hmm. And so that's what they're thinking. Yep. They are definitely thinking that they're going to have to act unilaterally. But we are waiting for that biblically prophesied relationship with Germany to definitely fire up here. And this could play a part in it.
Well, thank you very much, Brent. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the U.S. President Joe Biden's anti-Israel cabinet picks. He's working on an article on the subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much, Brent.
No worries.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Anger and frustration are building in many countries. We'll look at the growing problem of violence on the far left of the political spectrum in Germany in this report from Josue Michels.
Left-wing extremism reached another record high in Germany last year, according to data released in January by the Federal Ministry of the Interior. The number of violent crimes motivated by left-wing extremism in Germany rose from 1,052 in 2019 to 1,359 in 2020. Those are violent crimes, and that is an increase of 29%. In total, 9,973 left-wing extremist motivated crimes were recorded in 2020. In 2019, there were only 9,849. The indication is that political movements are becoming increasingly violent. In 2019, left-wing extremist crimes had risen by 40% over 2018. So we see that those crimes are continually rising. Linda Teuteberg, a Free Democrat and Interior Ministry, told Welt am Sonntag, quote, "In addition to the dynamic development in right-wing extremism and Islamism, the trend in left-wing extremism toward more and more acts of violence is also worrying," end of quote. Last year, Germany's intelligence agency observed a change in how the criminal actions are executed. Instead of mass militancy, we are seeing more and more clandestine small group actions. The hatred is no longer expressed toward institutions only, but now also on a personal level. The persecution of individuals is becoming increasingly popular. Months ago, Germany's intelligence agency revealed that at least 47 of the more than 100 Antifa groups nationwide are now being observed and classified as extremist. Some no doubt took inspiration from what happened in the US in 2020, and at the time German politicians warned about it, and now we are seeing the result. Antifa stands for Anti-Fascist Action. And as Die Welt noted, quote, the members of the Antifa scene are united in their more or less intensive struggle against people and activities they perceive as fascist, end of quote. But in fighting against fascism, these radical lefties have established their own terror regime. In 2019, German authorities identified 33,500 people as left-wing extremists, 9,200 of which are considered violent left-wing extremists. According to sources from Der Spiegel, Germany's domestic secret service categorized 32,080 people as potential right-wing extremists in 2019, up from 24,100 in 2018. This estimate includes 7,000 supporters of the radical wing of the far-right party Alternative für Deutschland. According to the Federal Office annual report, the number of violent right-wing extremists was 13,000 in 2019, and these numbers are also likely to increase in 2020 once we see the reports. All over Europe, the mood is intensifying. New movements are starting across the continent, opposing their government's respective coronavirus measures. Thousands of people no longer feel represented, as they feel drowned out by the mainstream media. The far left accuses the government of caring more for the rich than the working class. In many cases, those who are protesting in the streets just want change. They may not have a clear view of the cause of the problem or even any solution. They may feel drawn to right or left-wing ideologies. But whatever it is, they feel dissatisfied. And dissatisfied with the political class, millions have turned to violence. Rather than looking to their own governments or the political system for solutions, many today are vehemently opposing them. Historians will likely look back on these sentiments as a grave warning of a looming catastrophe. We are witnessing the vicious cycle of history repeat itself. Dissatisfaction leads to discontent. Discontent leads to violence. Violence leads to bloody revolutions and instability. Instability leads to the rise of strongmen. The Bible prophesies that this cycle will again unfold in Europe. In the case of Germany and Europe, the Bible specifically reveals that a common turmoil will lead to the rise of an authoritarian strongman. We have spoken often on this program and in our literature about these prophecies. We are seeing the stage set for them to be fulfilled. A prophecy in Daniel 8, verse 23 reads, "And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up." And has Germany's strongman finally arrived? Mr. Flui explained the time frame of this prophecy, and I quote from the article, "God revealed symbols of future events to the prophet Daniel. But interestingly, he did not explain to Daniel what those events would be. The prophecy was sealed until the time of the end. Daniel 8, verse 17, 12, verse 4 and 9. Compare these events to today, however, and it is clear that these prophecies are for now. Daniel 8, verse 23 describes a king of fierce countenance who rises to power not democratically, but by flatteries. Daniel 11, verse 21. The Bible prophesies that this powerful leader will reign over the king of the north, verse 40. He will be from a war-making nation descended from ancient Assyria, Germany, end of quote. Beginning in the 1930s, the late Herbert W. Armstrong prophesied about this coming strongman. After Adolf Hitler rose to power and lost the most devastating war in history, Mr. Armstrong warned that another strong leader would rise in the same spirit to bring even greater destruction. What we are seeing in Germany today is laying the groundwork for this earth-shaking prophecy to be fulfilled. I would encourage anyone listening to this program to order Mr. Gerald Lewis' free booklet, Daniel Unsealed at Last, to understand the full prophetic context of these passages and see how they are being fulfilled in our time.
Thank you very much for that, Josue. On this program, we've tended to focus more on the rise of the far right in Germany, and that is in response to problems associated with immigration and the sense that Germany's politicians have kind of abandoned some of the principles in protecting Germany from the outside and that type of thing. What you're talking about here is something of a mirror image of that trend. What are some of the factors that you see as driving this rise in the far left, and particularly the violent strain of the far left?
Yes, the motives of the far right are usually easier to pinpoint, but the far left is almost as equally violent as the far right, and they are motivated more by wanting to overthrow the established institutions. They believe that the huge gulf between the rich and the poor is a result of improper government, and they pinpoint it mostly to the United States and capitalism. And they do change, and the governments don't change no matter what the people are voting for. For example, for many, many years, there has been a left-wing party in the German parliament, and people are voting for it by the millions over the years, but no one wants to make a coalition with them, at least on the federal level, because the party is so extreme. So the millions of people that are voting for it see only one solution now. The vote doesn't change anything, so they are going on the streets themselves. And if that doesn't help, they are willing to use violence. They used violence against institutions. They were protesting against the United Nations meetings and things like that. And now they believe even that doesn't help, so they are attacking individuals that might be politicians or just someone with a different idea than they have.
Now, when we look at the far right, that tends to be more ideologically aligned with what we would expect from Germany, given what Bible prophecy says about the role that they're going to play in the world. How do you see this playing in? You're basically, if I understand from your report, you're saying that the unrest that this would create would basically increase the appetite for a strong man to come in there and set things right, that there's this sense of unraveling in society that must be met with a law and order type of response. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And that unrest can cause all kinds of things. And the left is usually against violence. For example, they're against Germany exporting weapons because they believe that's causing lots of poverty in those other nations, and it is. But they are also thinking about it in a different way now, because if they don't get their aim, we are seeing them turning violent. And if they see that that's a problem globally. We are seeing more and more hatred against America, and that's very significant in Bible prophecy, that hatred against Israel, modern-day America and Britain in particular. We're seeing that surge, and a certain leader, when he comes to power, he can tell them, I have a solution for you. It's not the nicest solution, but it has to be done to get our will done. And those people, those extremists, they will be like, yes, finally someone hears our plea. Finally someone has solutions, and they will be wholeheartedly supporting him. Although he might have a totally different idea of what the problem is, but he can identify it in a different way and explain it to the people that they believe him and they will be rallying behind him.
You know, I'm recalling, I guess it was about a year ago or so, that we were seeing uprisings, popular uprisings in several countries around the world. And we actually published a Trumpet edition called The Age of Protest, or something to that effect, that it was talking about just how much you had this unrest spreading through countries where populations were really dissatisfied with the status quo in the politics of their nations. And in a lot of ways, that was put on ice for a while because of coronavirus. It was like everyone was sent home and the doors were shuttered and the streets were empty. We saw a bit of a flaring up of that to some degree in America with the rise of the race riots and so on over the summer. But it does feel like that kind of moment that was frozen is now thawing, and that you have those same frustrations and hatreds and pent-up anger that is beginning to express itself again, where you have people out on the street. And I mean, the imagery is very similar, except you have a lot of protesters that are wearing face masks now. But it is pretty remarkable to see how all of the problems that were being expressed, none of that was solved. And in fact, a lot of the events over this past year seem to have exacerbated some of those issues.
Yes, and interesting is that they're coming back and they're more willing to use that violence, as the statistics show. You can even wonder how much the lockdowns were to keep those protests at bay that we have seen so much at Rising before. But now they're coming back, the problems are still the same, and the people are even more aggravated. They might have lost their jobs, they have been staying at home for some time, and they are looking into the media, and they can't believe what they're seeing, and they want change, and they want it more than ever before.
Well, we do appreciate you bringing that to us, Josue. We've been talking with trumpet writer Josue Michels about this rise in far-left violence in Germany. You can find his article on this subject on thetrumpet.com. The title of that is Antifa and Other Left-Wing Extremist Groups Breed Violence in Germany. Go check that out on the website. Thank you very much for your time, Josue.
Thanks for having me again.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Life is a precious thing. In fact, new scientific evidence shows just how precious, as we will now hear in this report from Mihailo Zekic.
How unique is life on Earth? In 1974, famed astronomer and television presenter Carl Sagan estimated that there could be up to a million different civilizations inhabiting the Milky Way galaxy. Is our galaxy really that optimal for life to exist? What about our Earth? Are conditions so optimal that the evolution of life on Earth would be a given? Scientists say that the Earth must have been capable of supporting life for billions of years, or life wouldn't have had enough time to evolve. Catastrophes, according to scientists' current models, could happen that would be able to destroy much life on Earth, but none of the catastrophes in Earth's history could be so bad that they could make the planet uninhabitable. The traditional explanation for how Earth was able to stay habitable for so long is because of stabilizing mechanisms, or natural mechanisms in the Earth's systems designed to nullify extreme changes to climate. But scientists aren't in agreement as to how these so-called stabilizing mechanisms work, and they are only hypothetical. Scientists estimate that Earth has been habitable for about 3 to 4 billion years. In December, Earth Systems Professor Toby Tyrell published a study from the University of Southampton. In his study, he plugged into a simulation 100,000 hypothetical planets, each with climate characteristics that were all random but habitable. Each planet went through 100 random adjustments in important factors like temperature. The study's aim was to discover how likely it was for each planet to remain habitable after the adjustments. Of the 100,000 planets, 8,710, or roughly 9%, remained habitable after at least one climate adjustment in the simulation. Only one planet remained habitable after all 100 changes. Tyrell's verdict was that, quote, Earth's long-lasting habitability was therefore most likely a contingent or accidental rather than an inevitable outcome, unquote. In other words, if Tyrell's views are correct, then humanity and life on Earth as a whole as it exists for no other reason than 4 billion years of extreme luck. Extreme luck even in the face of mass extinction events. Scientists estimate that Earth went through 5 such mass extinction events that took out creatures like the dinosaurs over the last 500 million years or so. According to scientists' models, those extinction events wiped out 75 to 90% of all species that have ever lived. And yet somehow, Earth can still support life today. Scientists also think that our closest planetary neighbors, Venus and Mars, were both habitable at one point. Neither, of course, can support life today. Venus is an acidic inferno, while Mars is in a deep freeze. The habitability of those two planets went under, but Earth's is still chugging for whatever reason. The habitability of those two planets went under, but Earth and its habitability still survives for some reason. It must have taken a miracle then for life on Earth to have evolved. That is, assuming Earth was around long enough for evolution to take place. Another study, published in November in Astrobiology magazine, questions this assumption. The study analyzes how many critical steps would be needed for intelligent life on Earth to evolve. Critical steps are the hypothetical major changes in Earth's biochemical systems needed for the evolution of intelligent life. According to scientists, major changes in Earth's systems had to take place for advancements like multicell organisms to evolve, or for the evolution from cellular division to sexual reproduction. Previously, scientists thought that only one or two would have been necessary. They now estimate that up to 12 would have been required, according to their models. The study concludes that, according to science's models and evolution, the evolutionary timeline would likely exceed the lifetime of Earth, perhaps by many orders of magnitude. The magazine Popular Mechanics writes that the study concludes that, quote, it would be virtually impossible for that life to evolve the same way somewhere else, unquote. In other words, the accepted view on the origins of life are very unrealistic. The more scientists look, the more they can see that Earth's capability to support life is unique. And not only can Earth support life, but it is optimal for supporting life, even intelligent life. Here are a few statistics. Earth is the perfect distance from both the Sun and the Moon to have a stable, predictable orbit. Earth has the perfect density to allow an atmosphere to both form and be habitable. Earth has just the right proportions of water in liquid, solid, and gas form to cool the planet from the sun without drowning the continents. Earth has just the right proportions of the 27 elements found in the human physiology needed for humans to be alive. The sun's size and distance from Earth is optimal for stable changes in Earth's temperature. Our planet has many more attributes necessary for life than the ones just described. One has to wonder why Earth, and the solar system itself, has all of these coincidental attributes necessary for life to thrive. Here's an even better question. Is it all a coincidence after all? Scientists don't like admitting this, but the results from studies like these latest two show the improbability of science's models for how life originated. That life could have progressed for billions of years, surviving one mass extinction event after another, becomes more and more improbable as science learns more and more. Trumpet managing editor Joel Hilliger writes in his free booklet, Our Awesome Universe Potential. Quote, scientists have come to refer to Earth as a Goldilocks planet. That is, in every conceivable way, conditions aren't too hot or too cold, too large or too small, too close or too far, too anything. No matter what is measured, it is just right. Not only for the existence of life, but also for discovery, and to a mind-boggling level of precision. Even the minutest deviation would make cosmic observation difficult or impossible, or would wipe out all prospect of life. Unquote. One cannot help but wonder, then, if Earth's perfectness is deliberate. To answer a question if this is all a coincidence, please request our free booklets, Our Awesome Universe Potential, and Does God Exist? Available at thetrumpet.com.
Thank you very much for that, Mihailo. So why is this recent evidence such a big blow to the standard view on how evolution works?
Well, scientists don't agree with themselves how they think life evolved, but the generally accepted theory is that 3 to 4 billion years ago, there was this primordial ooze, this like mixing in of chemical elements that somehow came together and formed a cell, which somehow was able to divide itself and reproduce itself. And then somehow along the lines, through billions and millions of years, different adaptations were evolved, such as sexual reproduction, like two organisms like sharing their DNA to create another organism, or sight, or breathing air. And scientists' theories for how that were to happen was through this idea of critical steps, as was mentioned, because Earth's atmosphere and conditions of life would obviously have to change dramatically from the primordial chaotic past to get there. And originally, scientists thought that it didn't really take much, that life could evolve on its own fairly naturally and that kind of thing. But this study, the second study in astrobiology specifically, shows that there's a lot more, if you would call it manipulation, that has to go on in order for life to begin to grow compared to what scientists believe now.
Mm. Now, so there's all this evidence. Really, they're looking right at the evidence that life is a miracle, that it was deliberately designed, that it was intelligently designed. And yet scientists, they're so convinced that life just happened that in order to explain, as the odds of this occurring, and not just occurring, but being able to be sustained over a period of millions and billions of years, as they're suggesting, they have to devise even more outlandish explanations for how this is possible. And in this article that you wrote on the subject, you even described how they're saying life came from outer space.
I don't want to put words into their mouth. They're not saying that that's what happened, but that's the only explanation they offered as to how it could have possibly sped up the process. As was mentioned, Mars used to be habitable at one point, and scientists theorized that it ended its habitability about 100 million years before Earth had its oceans. I'm not exactly sure how they come to those conclusions, but they think that asteroids have been impacting
our solar system for about 100 million years before that. So the best theory they can possibly give to how the process was sped up was, if there was life on Mars, like if we can consider Earth and Mars one system, then somehow an asteroid made it from Mars to Earth, or bounced or something, and carried the necessary missing ingredient needed to bring life on Earth. Now, the big thing with this is, okay, maybe Mars was habitable in the past, but there's no evidence to suggest that there was ever any life on Mars or anywhere outside of Earth. You have to first find evidence that there was life on Mars before you can make the claim that life came from Mars to Earth. And Martian exploration is so limited. It's basically been limited to a few rovers. So it's not like we have like as detailed of a view as to exactly how Mars came and what every little million years, like how the planet changed and that kind of thing. So at the very even a lot of the assumptions scientists make is speculative as at best with how limited evidence we have.
But you have to give them credit for their obstinacy in clinging to this idea that somehow this all took place. I guess if you want to put it that way, they've been very very stubborn in clinging to that. But it is remarkable just seeing the evidence that is emerging here. It does give you that much more appreciation for just what a marvel we are witness to and a part of.
Oh, very. I mean, you look around the planets and of our solar system. As was mentioned, Venus is full of toxic acid. Mars is in a deep freeze, and those are the nicest of all the planets we can
right.
see. You look at Mercury; it's like even more hostile to surviving. And the gas giants—they're basically puffs of toxic gas. There's nothing that's really going to live in there. But Earth, it's just perfectly fine-tuned. Not just for life, but for advanced life. I mean, the fact that we have a human civilization that can learn as much as we do, that can look at all the ways life portrays itself on Earth, all the animals, all the plants, all its Earth systems that are capable of sustaining life, and the fact that we can send rovers to Mars, the fact that we can send satellites to go and orbit Saturn or Uranus and take photos of these planets, and like these things don't just happen on their own. It's like the analogy a lot of people like to give is a watchmaker. You look at a watch and all its fine-tuned precision, and like it's obviously somebody designed each piece to function in a way, and that's a perfect analogy of how Earth works.
Marvelous. Well, thank you for that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic about new evidence of the specialness of life on Earth. He's written an article about this. Is life on Earth one unlikely fluke? You can find that at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Mihailo.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
When I was a senior in high school, we staged a production of the musical Paint Your Wagon. One of my friends, on a whim, joined, and he dared me to join along with him. And I'd never done anything like that. I'd never even thought to do that. I had no desire to do it. But for some reason, I thought, well, why not? So I became a member of the chorus named Jack. And I really found myself enjoying the rehearsals. I got into the experience a whole lot more than I would have expected. Now, there was one solo in this musical. There was a set with a bunch of the cowboys sitting around a campfire. And this song could have been sung by anyone in the chorus. The song is They Call the Wind Mariah. And the director chose another boy to sing this song. But I decided to go ahead and learn the song anyway. And every day when I would drive home from the rehearsal, I would practice singing this song there in the confines of my car. Away out there they got a name for rain and wind and fire. The rain is Tess, the fire's Joe, and they call the wind Mariah. And this song built up higher and higher as it reached the finale until it hit a peak. Mariah, Mariah, they call the wind Mariah, Mariah, Mariah. And you can just imagine me driving in my car all by myself, no one to hear me, all protected by the glass and the confines of my car. Blow my love to me. As long as I was in my car, I could sing out with gusto, and the more and more confident I became singing this song. Now, I told my friend about it, and he said, well, hey, you should do that in the show. That idea petrified me, but I was also secretly kind of excited by the idea. I'd never said anything to the director about it, but I think that my friend might have. And there was one rehearsal. We were getting kind of close to the performance, and the scene around the campfire came up, and the boy who sang that song wasn't there at that rehearsal. Well, the director said, Joel, you sing Mariah. This was my chance. I mean, I'd been practicing. I could hit those notes. I knew the song. The only problem was I had never once sang so that anyone else could hear me. I had never sung outside of my 1979 Honda Civic. So the accompaniment started, and there in that rehearsal, I stepped out in front of the director and all of my peers, all my classmates, and I introduced the world to my singing voice. And I lost my nerve completely. Rather than singing this song the way I had been practicing, I turned it into a total joke. I clowned my way through it. I hammed it up. I had everybody laughing. But the fact was, I didn't have the guts to actually sing out. So I blew the one chance I had to actually show the director I was capable of singing that song. When I think back on my life, that is one experience I wish I could do over. Now, thankfully, that experience actually began to change me. I failed in that specific instance, but I came away more determined to come out of myself. Now, you've probably heard Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10, this biblical verse that says, "Whatsoever your hand finds to do, do it with your might." Now, what's interesting is that verse doesn't end there. It actually goes on to give a reason why we should do everything with all our might. It says, "For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave where you go." So you're heading for the grave. So what should you do about it? Well, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Do it with all your strength. Life is short. You only have so much time, so don't waste it. Make the most of it. It's wonderful instruction from God. Don't sleepwalk through life. Don't be half-hearted. Don't be passive. Don't sit around and wait for opportunities to land in your lap. Seize the day. Push yourself. Prepare for opportunity. Make opportunity. And when that comes, make sure you grab it. Don't let fear hold you back. We are what we are in life, in part because of what we do when opportunities come our way. And really, many of us are very passive. We wait for life to happen to us. Most people, I would say, are too comfortable just sitting back in the background or hanging back in the chorus. But life is short. And the fact is, if you're not making the most of it, at some point you will come to regret that. Maybe we all have regrets and things that we wish that we had done better as we look back at our lives, or opportunities that we missed. There's a verse that's very similar to Ecclesiastes 9:10. Colossians 3 and verse 23, the New International Version says, "Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord." Now, that's an admonition we all need to remember. We all get too comfortable in our little ruts and fail to put real energy into life. But God doesn't want us to be half-hearted. He wants us to be wholehearted. He wants us to live with energy, with effort and enthusiasm, with joy. Nobody is truly successful who doesn't seize the moment when opportunity comes. I'm going to quickly show you two contrasting stories of people in the Bible, two different responses to opportunity. The first is in Matthew chapter 4. And here, James and John, they were commercial fishermen on the northeastern shore of the Galilee in business with their father. And this is what it says happened one day. It says, "Going on from there, Jesus saw other two brothers, James the son of Zebedee and John his brother, in a ship with Zebedee their father, mending their nets, and he called them." So Christ walked by, he looked these men in the eyes, and he said, "Hey, I want you on my team." Opportunity came knocking. And verse 22 says, "And they immediately left their ship and their father and followed him." They answered the knock. They stepped up and seized that opportunity. Now, the second story is in Acts 24. Felix was a Roman governor, and he had the chance to hear the truth of God from the Apostle Paul. And this is what it says in Acts 24 and verse 24. "After certain days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, which was a Jewess, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ." So he had a golden opportunity here, and Paul presented the truth of God to him, and this was Felix's response. Verse 25 says, "As he reasoned of righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come, Felix trembled." He was really struck by this truth. But this is what he said. He answered, "Go your way for this time. When I have a convenient season, I will call for you." You know, that's good enough for now. You can go. When I find it convenient, I'll send for you. This isn't a good time for me. Don't call me, I'll call you. This is the way so many people are. It shows when an opportunity is tragically wasted. John Greenleaf Whittier said, "For all sad words of tongue or pen, the saddest are these, it might have been." In some ways, I think this is a lesson I've continued to learn more deeply through my whole life. I've learned in life to sing out. I've learned to step up, to go for it when an opportunity arises, and not to be afraid of that. I've learned to give more and to seize opportunities to become a bigger person. But in some ways, I'm still coming to see just how important it is to seize opportunities. And the longer I live, the more I realize there are a lot more opportunities than you think. In fact, every day offers opportunities to step out and be a bigger person. Every conversation you have is an opportunity if you open your eyes. Life is really an unbroken string of opportunities. So don't take things for granted. Don't be asleep. Wake up to opportunity. Ask God to open your eyes to opportunity, and then use every opportunity as a stepping stone to greater opportunities in the future. Turn every opportunity into a victory. Don't leave your voice in the car. Unleash it on the stage. And whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal, Josue Michels, and Mihailo Zekic. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Helen Keller. "Keep your face to the sun, and you will never see the shadows." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.